You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
Thank you, Steve, for joining us on the Nova Business Podcast.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I would like to start off by asking you to tell us about a leader or a mentor that you had early on that was really impactful for your life.
Well, you know, in some sense, my dad was that. My dad was a very stern guy. I didn't appreciate him at the time. He was a very disciplined guy, but he was kind of the left brain leader. You know, he was the kind of guy that he was very strict with rules and very disciplined. At the same time, my mother was a different kind of leader. She was much more from the heart. My father was Russian. My mother was Italian. I mean, these were, you know, old time Russian. He spoke Russian. She spoke Italian. And the two of them together created this sort of right brain, left brain in the way I operate. And it's a pretty amazing thing that happened because I make decisions using both the right brain and left brain. I argue with myself a lot. I tend to be a little bit more right brain than left brain, but I learned a lot of discipline from my dad, and that's really taken me to great places. And when I was young, I never appreciated it. I always thought he was a hard ass, you know, that kind of thing. But my mother, big Italian lady, you know, manja manja kind of lady, always open arms with everybody, you know, that kind. Now, I tend to be more like her, but I still have that sort of Marine Corps. I went in the Marine Corps. I sort of still have that military ability to whatever I need to do, I can buckle down and get it done. So I'd sort of take both of them as great mentors along the way. I mean, there were certainly other mentors along the way, professors in school and folks like that, that I have great respect for and took me a long way. But I think if I had to look back now, and you know, I've got a long road and a history to look back now, I can and put it in perspective. I think they really taught me the most about leadership without me even knowing that was what it was all about.
I want to dig into this a little because you automatically went into how your parents impacted the way you are as a person. So yeah. How do you see these experiences or childhood experiences impact the way leaders in general lead out there for businesses?
Well, I think you're seeing some of that played out in the political forum these days where, you know, people respond, I think, based on some very deeply rooted fears and hopes and perspectives that they learned very young. I really do. I think that emotions are etched very deeply in your brain and hypothalamus. And so when you experience something emotionally, like I'll give you a good example. I'm very afraid of heights. My cousin Nicky, who's kind of a jerk, I hope he hears this thing. He was a bully as a kid. He'll never hear it anyway. He's out in the West somewhere. But we were on a second story balcony of our apartment building, and he pushed me over the edge and, you know, as if he was going to push me out, and I went halfway over. He held me, so I didn't actually go over, but it scared the hell out of me. And to this very day, I'm deathly afraid of heights. You know, and when I get near balconies, I break into a sweat. Now, I can fly in a plane fine, but I do think a lot of what happens to us at a very young age kind of affects and colors the way we make decisions. I certainly don't ever get in a ladder and paint my house. I wouldn't, you know, I guess if my wife were in danger, I'd suck it up and do something to get her. But boy, I'd sure hope somebody else was around. I think there's some primordial stuff in there that inside all of us that gets etched in a very young age. Kids that are parented by very anxious parents tend to be anxious later in their life. There's almost there's actually some DNA work at work there when the brain cells can be affected at a very young age. We sort of know that. You don't think of it often, but it's a great question. You know, I'm sure I picked up a lot of stuff at a very early age. One of the things I picked up was, I have to say this, this is an interesting thought, Jess, was my mother worked as a meat packer. My father was a truck driver. I mean, that's the kind of background, you know, meat and potatoes kind of thing. And she worked at a Stop and Shop. And before work every day, she would get a donut and coffee at a Dunkin' Donuts, because that's where it started up in Boston. And one of the woman who took care of her house burned down and she lost everything. She had some kids. And so one day I go home to my house and my room, my mother's rifling through all my clothes and she's throwing stuff on the bed. I mean, good stuff that I was wearing. And she says, well, you haven't worn this for a while. You haven't worn that. And she was putting together this box for this woman. And I said, Mom, you know, you're taking all my clothes. She says, you don't wear this stuff. I'm going to take it. That was the kind of early exposure I had to generosity. My mother's generosity was enormous. If she had a dollar, she'd give you 50 cents. Hell, she might give you 75 cents, depending how bad it was. And I learned that that was etched in me very early on. And it's interesting because I work with a bunch of CEOs, and I got about 20 of them together, young kids, you know, in their 30s and 40s. And I started teaching them generosity. I did this for 6 years, and many of them have now sold companies and made lots of money and have given back a lot. And I did that, giving back a lot to this region. I did that because I don't think a lot of people necessarily learn generosity always at home. And I thought, well, time to teach these kids how to give back. And I don't know why I talked about it. I riffed on that, but it was one of those things that I learned very early on. It's up here, you know, it's not. And so my wife is funny. We've been married forever. Well, it'd be 50 years this year. So my wife, who I love dearly, I mean, just beyond belief, was a very conservative giver. Let's put it that way. She would give she went to Mary Washington. She would give them $100 or $50. And I said, honey, more money to process that than anything else. And so now we're giving hundreds of thousands, you know, we're giving lots of money away now. And she's doing it very easily. You know, she writes checks for 20,000 or 15,000 or 10,000, like you were writing a check for, for some groceries or something. And it's because over the years I've infected her. I've infected her and just kept saying, let's push it. Now, she's a very generous person, but don't get me wrong, but if you get in the habit very young with her parents, I think were very conservative, very generous people, but conservative, I tend to be a little bit more like my mom. And I think that has had some effects along the way. Anyway.
Well, I want to kind of do a little bit more on that. And I want to dig into it because I'm doing the math on this. So your parents, so father's Russian, mother's Italian. Yeah. I mean, when did they meet?
I was born in 1946, right after the war. When did they meet? Did they meet before the war?
And that's kind of where I'm going on this. It's interesting, you know, Russian father, Italian mother, right? Meet after or prior to World War II.
Yeah.
You come along.
Mm-hmm.
They were first generation, I'm assuming, Americans.
Second.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then along comes Steve.
Yeah.
And Steve is raised in this household, and Steve works through his curriculum, right? Goes through and then joins the Marine Corps. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about that. You know, what was that like? You know, you're at that point, you know, third generation American, you know, living through that. What was that like for you? Is that kind of like going back to, you know, your dad who was a hard ass and, you know, schooling you up, or what was that like for you?
So the time I go in the Marine Corps is 1968, the height of Vietnam. All right. I mean, there's a draft. Everybody's going to go. If depending on what your number is, my number looks like it's low. A bunch of guys get drunk one night and they're in a dormitory down in Providence College, and everybody's talking about going in the Marine Corps. And I ended up going in the Marine Corps, and I'm not sure anybody, and one other guy did later after me, but I ended up actually going in. And, you know, my father was a kind of a World War II hero kind of guy. And when I told him, he said, oh, I think it's good for you. You know, and my mother was like, oh God, don't do this. I went anyway, but it was during that time when Vietnam was just exploding. And of course, right after that, then all the protests, the Chicago 7, you know, all the stuff that, you know, we found out about Vietnam was wrong. I mean, it was kind of like Iraq, you know, we found out, well, there weren't any weapons there. That was all kind of just like made up or something. Disappointing, to say the least, but you learn so much when so much is at stake. I mean, I learned things I could never learn. And if you survive war, the lessons that you learn are amazing. But that's how I got into it. It was right at the height of Vietnam and people getting drafted. There was no, you know, it's hard to dodge. You know, some guys went to Canada and places like that for a couple of years. That wasn't in our DNA, my DNA back then. I think I'd have a very different opinion about it today, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's interesting you drew that correlation. I mean, that's kind of the same, you know, history repeats itself kind of thing, right? So you return home from Vietnam, and how do you end up at the FBI?
Well, I was going to go to medical school. I decided after I got back from Vietnam, I met my wife after I got back, and we started dating, and I decided to, I said, I'm going to go to med school. And so at UMass, I was accepted at UMass in their graduate as a special graduate student to get these classes done. And I said to my then girlfriend, well, you know, girlfriend, whatever, she was a fiance at the time. I just said, hey, I'm going to go up. You want to come and hang out? And she said, well, I'm not going to come up unless we're married, you know, that kind of thing. And I mean, it wasn't a threat or anything. She said, I'm not going to go up and live with you kind of thing. And we decided that, hey, let's get married. And we did. We got married and went up to Massachusetts and went to University of Massachusetts. It took a bunch of courses. I did okay in the courses. I went to school in the daytime. At night, I managed a restaurant up there at the campus center on campus. I had some experience managing before, and I parlayed that in my age. You know, because I was 25 at the time, the kids I was supervising were in the 18 or 19. So I had some managerial presence, you know, that kind of thing, and did okay. But I really found out I'm dyslexic, by the way, and it makes everything I do harder. I mean, that's why the discipline helps. It just makes it much harder. It takes me twice as long to read something that you would read, but I just take the time. Anyway, I started having problems with science. God, I was just terrible. I would switch things, you know, if you're dyslexic, you switch things around. And so chemistry, you know, was terrible for me. Anyway, I finally figured out this isn't going to work. I can't do this for four more years. So I called my wife. I called her. I went home and I said, hey, I just can't do this. And I said, I think I'm going to join the FBI, because when I was at Quantico with the Marine Corps and I got back in Vietnam, I knew a bunch of FBI folks because they're right at Quantico. I ended up applying, I got accepted, and then boom, I'm into the FBI. And that was a good transition at a time that was tough for me. But, you know, most FBI agents are just former military guys with suits on instead of uniforms, that kind of thing, you know. So it was an easy transition, and they treated me well. I mean, the FBI was good to me. It was a great job. It was fun. You know, I wasn't a great FBI. I wrote a book, I haven't published it, called The Tales of a Weird FBI Agent. I wasn't a great FBI agent. I really wasn't. I can't find things. I'm not good at detail. I don't like to follow law. I mean, you know, strictly, I'm kind of flexible, and I could always understand why people did what they did. And I was like, you know, I'm not sure we should arrest this guy. And, you know, I wasn't like that. And so, but I did it. And so I ended up, because I was I had a literary background, I ended up doing things like I was the chief speechwriter for the director. I taught at Quantico. I was ahead of publications for the FBI. So I sort of gravitated into the area that it's a big enough organization that you can sort of, I did all the shoot 'em up stuff when I was young. And then I migrated into some of these other things, and I met some really interesting people, did some great stuff. And, I mean, it was fun stuff. And then I decided right at the end, when I had about 5 years to go, I'll get my PhD and I'll write a couple of books and I'll go into academia. And that's what I did. And then after that, I went to UVA.
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, one of the things you mentioned is, you know, you're dyslexic, and you go on to be a speechwriter for the FBI. You do a bunch of training. You know, you go off in academia. You know, was that hard for you? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's really hard. I love to learn, and so I'm willing to put the time in. I mean, my mantra is, you know, and this is really true. I mean, if you and I sat down to read and really understand the book, assuming you don't have dyslexia, you could probably do it in, say, 4 hours, 5 hours. You could read a book and understand it. It would take me 20 15 or 20. You know, it just would take me, it takes me forever. I'd have to read it and underline it. Then I'd have to write it up and I'd have to put it in. And I mean, I go through these unbelievable machinations to understand a book. It's just, you can't even begin to know how much work it takes. But I'm willing to do that because I love to learn and I wanted to be successful at what I did. So I put the time in. It's hard. It's very hard. I have a great, I watched a guy teaching teachers one day, and this is pretty interesting. He was teaching teachers what it's like to be ADHD and not being able to, and dyslexic, not being able to take in stimulus. And so what he did was he gave them an assignment. Then immediately after giving the assignment, he started talking to them and trying to interrupt them. And they just couldn't hold a train of thought because if you start hearing language, it starts to disrupt you. And they just couldn't finish the assignment. He says, that's how it is for a kid with learning disability. So I'm very sensitive to what it's like to have a learning disability because I've had one.
Well, it's interesting. The timing, I was doing research this morning. I was, working on a project for a client and it was all around benefits for dyslexic parents and children, to be able to help support them. But what's interesting is that most of the publications out there say it's a blessing for a business to have a dyslexic employee because they think three-dimensionally.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree with that or if you've got stories on that, but maybe is that also part of kind of where you find yourself today, why you've been so successful in helping other leaders?
Yeah, I'm a high creative. I mean, if you look at my testing, I always come out of highly creative. I can create things in a minute. I mean, it's something that might take you hours and hours to think of. You put me in a room and say, come up with 4 solutions. I'll come up with 20. That's the blessing. Cause I don't know how it works, but I'm very extremely creative. It can drive you nuts. Cause when I was heading up a division, I'd walk in and say, hey, let's try this and let's try that. And I'd have people all over the place and you can exhaust people with that too. So you have to be really careful. And this is what I tell leaders is you have to announce where you are. If you're just brainstorming, tell people that's what you're doing. Don't, if you're blue skying it, tell them, I am just blue skying it. Because otherwise they're running off thinking you've just given them an assignment. And what we say is, when you're saying, hey, I really mean this, tell people that. And so I got used to just announcing to my staff. I'd say, hey, listen, I'm just messing around here. I'm just playing, And that helped. That helps a lot when you're highly creative. But that's my strength. The strength is creativity. And that's why I write all these books. I really write books to understand what I'm really learning and interested in.
I want to know what you saw while you were managing at the restaurant during college, during the military, during the FBI. I mean, what were some of these things that you saw around leadership teams? I know one of the great leaders that you spoke about or that you write about is Stanley McChrystal. And so I don't know if there's anything you have to share on that as well.
Well, he's a great leader. I met Stan. I used to write for 15 years. I've been off for this last year because of COVID, but for 15 or 20 years, I can't remember when I started. I used to write in Old Town. I go to Old Town in Virginia and write. And I've been in various restaurants. I've worked in different restaurants that some have gone under and changed. And anyway, I was at this bagel place and I found it. And one day I was typing and I had just posted his TED Talk just online. I post a lot of stuff online. And as I'm typing, this guy comes in, he runs in, he's got his running stuff on, and he's with his wife, and he runs in, and he sits down at a table, I could almost touch him, and I'm typing away, and he takes his hat off, and I go, holy crap, I think this is Stan McChrystal. And then I called up the picture of him, and I looked at him, and I looked back, and I couldn't resist, and I said, hey, I'm sorry to bother you, sir. I said, but are you Stan McChrystal? He says, yeah, I am. I said, and I showed him. I just posted your thing online. And I got to know him. He would come in every Saturday, and we'd chit-chat a little bit about kids and whatever. And that's kind of how I got to know him. We're not best friends, and I'm not even sure he'd probably remember me. They probably remember me if I emailed him. But it was, he's just such a great leader. I mean, I think his big tenet was communicating and distributed leadership. You got to trust people and you got to communicate with them, which has always been something that I've taught for years and years. Trust is number one. If you can establish trust with people, you can get a lot a lot more out of them. And you have to be able to communicate with them. And that, I think he was able to communicate in a very complex setting with thousands of people. It's kind of how he did it in his book, Team of Teams. If you, I don't know if you've read that or heard about it, but that's kind of what he professes in it. A fabulous guy. I mean, I forgot what the question was.
Yeah, no, that was great. And we're actually interviewing his partner on the podcast in a few weeks, Chris Bussell.
Yeah. No, Chris may or may not remember me because we've communicated a couple times. He's a great guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like the work that they've done. They did a second book, a follow-up book as well.
Yeah.
And Chris did another one, I think, because he was writing with a kid from Yale for a while. I can't remember his name. Because I think McChrystal was maybe stationed at Yale for a little bit. You know, they give these guys sabbaticals, and I think that's how we bumped into that guy. But McChrystal's a great leader and a grounded kind of guy. And when I watched him with his granddaughter and with his wife and his kids at this, you know, in this bagel place, you know, he was just a pretty cool guy. I mean, he's pretty feet on the ground kind of guy. I think he would be a great guy to hang out with and a great guy to learn from.
Yeah. Well, what type of leaders did you see as you were going through, becoming a manager while you're in college, the FBI, the military? Did you have some of these inspiring leaders in your life?
Yeah. So I'll tell you about two opposites. How's that? When I was the head of counterterrorism in Washington, D.C., I ran the two squads of counterterrorism in Washington, D.C. It was a really big job. It was a tough job. You know, it was one of those jobs where anything that blew up, anything that happened, that was my responsibility in Washington. We in and out of the White House, we were all over the place. I mean, there was a lot of responsibility. And there was a lot of work. I mean, it's a 24/7 job. And one guy I worked for, his name is Phil. He was in charge of a bunch of our groups, and I was one of the people in his group, and my squad fell into that. Great guy, and he was honest. He was funny. He was the kind of guy that always had your back. He was the kind of guy that if things went wrong, he was there. If people got hurt, he was in the hospital. If you had a great bust, he'd be getting a beer with you at, you know, after it was all over with. That kind of guy. He gets promoted. And everybody is just so happy for him, but really sad for us because Phil was such a great guy. He's one of these, you know, once in a lifetime bosses. So we were hoping that somebody would come in and replace him who would be sort of like Phil, you know, honest, straightforward, great guy, always there. And in walked a guy named Bill. These are true names. This guy was the biggest jerk I have ever worked for in my entire life. He was backbiting. He was divisive. And I'm not talking about a politician right now. This guy actually worked at the FBI. He was divisive. He made you feel, you know, unwanted. He talked down to people. He was really a jerk. And what ends up happening is that one after one, people left, started to leave. You know, it's like the Von Trapp family, you know, goodbye, farewell. And one by one, everybody started leaving. And that's what happens. It was a great lesson for me because with Phil, everybody wanted to get work for him. With Bill, everybody wanted to leave him because he was such a jerk. And it was such a great and such an immediate contrast. I'll never forget. In fact, in my book, Positive Leadership, I actually put that story in it because I really wanted that to resonate. It was that kind of stark reality. I've had a chance to work for some great leaders. One of the best leaders I worked for is a woman at University of Virginia. When I left the FBI, the FBI has a special relationship at the academy with UVA. All the courses are accredited through UVA. A lot of people don't know that, but it started back with the legal department. They wanted to have it grounded in law and they wanted to have it grounded at a university. So when I retired, they heard I was retiring and said, hey, would you want to come and work for UVA and be a faculty member running our Falls Church Center? And so that's what I did. And I worked for this woman whose name is Sandra Stallard, who still lives in Old Town. Absolutely one of the funniest, absolutely one of the smartest and one of the best leaders I've ever worked for. She was compassionate. She was funny. She was decisive. When she made a decision, that was the decision. And she would amend it if she got more information. But intelligent, just a phenomenal leader. And I stayed, I probably should have only stayed 5 years and gone on because I had other things I wanted to do. But because I liked her so much, I ended up spending 10 years there. And then I started my own business doing what I do now. But she was probably one of the, if not the best, one of the best for sure.
Yeah. Well, in leading teams, you talk about how maybe 20% of teams are effective. And right. I also heard that the stat of 37% of teams are mediocre. Yep. And I look to my right, I look to my left, and you know, you're likely, you look in the mirror, you're likely part of one of those mediocre or not, you know, ineffective teams.
Yeah.
I mean, what makes for an effective team?
Well, what we have found, and I had done 3 or 4 years of research on this. I'd read as much as I could, and right toward the end, I was about 90% had the book written. That's when I discovered some research that had been going on at Harvard for about 25 years, and I felt like an idiot. But yeah, sometimes you find this right at the end. It's just what happens when you're doing stuff. And this guy named Richard Hackman and Ruth Wegman, the two of them, and several others, but two of them are the two main authors, had done a lot of work, but they hadn't released, they had done a lot of work on what makes a great team, but they hadn't released the information. They hadn't released the assessment that they developed until 2017, late 2017. I found out about it in like 2019. And the minute I found out about it, I said, my God, this is great research. Very valid, very reliable. And so we went up to Philadelphia and met with people who were working on this stuff, and they trained me and my daughter, actually, and we started using that. But the great breakthrough they had was that great teams, you know, like most of the times you get called into a team problem when everybody is fighting with each other, you know, they're not getting along, or there's silos, or Mary doesn't like Joe, Harry doesn't talk to this guy. And you get the sort of interpersonal behavioral things. That's when people call you in. And so what a lot of people have been doing, and what I used to do, was try to work with personality types and, you know, try to get people, you know, to talk with each other and tell the truth and be trusted and all that stuff, which is fine, but it really doesn't work as well as actually working on the structural design of the team. And what we find is that if the team is designed correctly, that a lot of this stuff goes, a lot of this noise goes away. And I heard a guy yesterday on a podcast. This is amazing. I mean, I heard this yesterday on a podcast. He was being interviewed by these people it's called Six Conditions. He was being interviewed, and he said it's like a garden. And I think it's one of the best analogies. He says if the garden essentially requires sunlight, most gardens do, add all your, you know, your fertilizer and stuff to it. If you put that garden in the shade, it doesn't matter how much fertilizer you put on, it doesn't matter how much you water it, it's not going to grow. And that's the best analogy I've ever heard. You gotta have this thing. The structure has to be set first, and that's the major level. And things like, you know, do you really have a team? I mean, that sounds like a silly requirement, but a lot of times people don't have a team. They have a bunch of people gathered in groups that don't work together, that aren't interdependent, and they just kind of work for the same person. That's not a team. It's a gathering, you know, it's a reporting structure, but it's a team. It's more like a golf team than it is a basketball team. You know, where one thing you're adding up the scores in basketball, if I do a lousy pass to you, it affects whether or not you get a layup, right? I mean, it just affects it. So there are things that they discovered that are structural in nature. And structure precedes behavior is what the great outcome was of their research.
I think it's interesting you use the garden example. You know, like, it sounds a lot like my garden, you know, it just doesn't grow, right? But, you know, I also think about, I don't know if you're familiar with this part, you know, so bees and bee colonies, right? So in bee colonies, you know, I kind of look at it like, hey, I'm the guy that's got to keep this thing together. You know, you talk about leadership, like, of course, it's got a queen and you can't circumvent nature, but a bee's natural tendency is to swarm. And when the hive swarms, you know, that's like losing people from your team. Right? Because one person leaves, they take a bunch of bees with them, they take resources, you know, you equate that back to the business. So when you think about where a business is today, so where businesses are today, we're recording this, you know, a couple of days here before Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving, Steve, 2020, you know, when you look at this year and you look at where businesses are, where do you think businesses should be putting their efforts as far as their leadership? You know, what should leadership teams be focusing on today if they haven't already?
Taking care of their folks, taking care of people. I mean, the first thing on a call that I do with my clients or anybody else, I say, how are you doing? How's your family doing? I was working with a bunch of cops just a week or two ago. Everything to me is yesterday, but it was like a few weeks ago. And I was doing a focus group and we went around and, you know, I was asking people for their silver lining. What have you gotten out of all this that really has been good? I mean, a lot of times, like my wife and I just really found out we could live together. Yeah, because yeah, most of the time I was leaving the house every day going working. But now I really know I could live with my wife and we wouldn't kill each other. I mean, we really do like each other. But that's a silver lining. And we went around and I was looking for this sort of happy face, silver lining kind of thing. And one guy said, I don't have much. He said, four of my family have been affected by COVID and are either dying or are dead. And it was just a showstopper. And I just my heart went out to him. I said, I'm so sorry. And I sent him a note after it was over. And we talked after it because I just felt like I was trying to be so glib and I felt bad about just trying to put a smiley face out there. And, you know, most of the time it works, but this guy had really just been through the ringer. So I think one of the first things leaders need to be is first sensitive to the, especially women. I mean, if you're a woman and you've got kids and you're teaching them at home and you're stuck at home with them, and I'm not trying to be sexist, but that oftentimes is where it falls, your career is screwed. I mean, you know, so I think being absolutely sensitive to those folks, to who's ever taking care of kids, asking them how they're feeling, how they're doing, before you set off into business. It's, you know, business will take care of itself down the road. Right now, you got to take care of people. We're in the middle of just an amazing, I mean, you'll never see this again, hopefully, for another 100 years, I hope. So I think that's what businesses should spend. They should teach empathy as a piece of business. And the really good ones, I was in a call yesterday, one of my clients, a very high-level guy at an international firm, and this guy's had his teeth kicked in. You know, if you're really good, you've had your butt kicked before you get in these positions. And he's really sensitive now to all that's going on. I think because he's been there before. It's new leaders need to be shown this because I think a lot of times they think they need to be hard and get the job done. And I think the job is secondary. I really do.
Well, let me ask this question because, you know, you brought up something and what we talk about is we talk about soft skills, right? And I don't know if there's any truth to this. You might know. I've heard that in some of the top, you know, MBA programs, which I won't name the schools, they actually allocate time to try to teach soft skills.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, what's your pulse? Like, how do you teach it? Is it something you learn? Like, what is your advice to a leader who says, hey, I don't know if I have soft skills or not?
So the idea, a hard skill is any skill you don't have. That's a hard skill. So if you don't know how to communicate, that's a hard skill for you. You don't know how to, if you're not compassionate, that's a hard skill. It's an easy skill for me, but it's a hard skill for somebody else. So I really think that's the difference. I mean, I don't think there's anything. I used to think, well, hard skills are math, science, you know, business, economics. Yeah, you know, but they're hard only if they're hard for you. And what I just tell people is a hard skill is whatever is hard for you. And it may be on the, you know, if we think head and heart, the Jefferson's famous, you know, soliloquy, you know, head is being sort of left brain and heart is being sort of right brain. If you think of it that way, I think universities, well, it's interesting because I just read a dissertation. A friend of mine just did a dissertation on MBA programs and I can't recall all the detail right now, but what she found was that professors liked to teach subjects that were hard skill kind of, and that students wanted to learn leadership, which was different than what these guys wanted to teach. And companies really wanted communication and teamwork skills. That's what companies actually want. They actually want very different things. I mean, this was done by the people who did the research on GMATs. I mean, produced the GMAT. So they kind of have a handle on this stuff. I think my message to MBA programs is pay attention to the personal skills because that's what's going to separate them. Yeah, you've got to understand certain things like advertising and marketing and things like that. That's fine. You got to have some skills in those areas, but you also have to, if you're going to be a leader, you've got to really understand how do you deal with people and how do you get teams to work together? What's some of the theory around teams and communication? Because that's And businesses know that. That's why they were, that's what, if you see the this dissertation that she has, the matrix, if you see what they're looking for, teamwork and communication. Can you write, speak, boom, boom, boom? Can you get along? Can you influence people? Can you, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what they want, because that's where teams are now. And they're all matrixed. There's no such thing right now as everything's virtual. Used to be, you know, we've got a virtual team. Now it's shit, everything's virtual. You know, I'm not sure we'll ever go back to the old, even a year or two from now. And I'm not sure we'll go back to, you're not going to want to go back to the way it was, having to drive into DC every day. That's nuts. You know, I mean, imagine spending 3 hours a day. I mean, our kids' kids are going to look back and think, people actually did that. They actually drove for 3 hours a day.
Or walked uphill both ways.
Yeah, basically.
No, we agree with that. But I think the basis for what we're talking about with soft skills, as well as being empathetic and taking care of your employees, is relationships. And yeah. I know that you have written some material around, you know, the key around being a great leader is strong relationships. And it made me think of Scott Galloway, an NYU professor who I like. He has a podcast, but also wrote the book, The Algebra of Happiness. And so he talks about how strong relationships, meaningful relationships, is the most important factor in success and happiness. Can you elaborate on this? What makes and destroys relationships?
Well, trust is the, so I wrote a book on trust. And what we found out is that trust is composed of three things. And trust is, it's the core of every relationship. If you're married or you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or wife, whatever, just think about relationship you have is based on trust. And trust is, do you have it's like, we call it the trust triangle. Does a person have character? Are they honest? Do they fall through with what they say they're going to do? Do they, you know, are they dependable? You know, basic honesty, integrity, that kind of stuff. Second piece of that is, are they competent? So character is number one. Number two is, are they competent? Are they competent not only as human beings, can they do things they're supposed to do, but are they competent in terms of interpersonal relationships and things like that? And especially in professions, like if you're going to head up a benefits program that you guys do, has the person worked in the field? Do they really know benefits? Or did they just get put in a position because their father owned the company? That happens all the time. In medicine, if you're going to run a hospital, you better be a doctor. And in law, you better be a lawyer. You don't have to be the best lawyer. You just have to have been in a courtroom. And then the last piece of that is caring. So it's character, competence, and care. Do you care about the person? Do you show that caring? How do you show that caring to the other person? And do you care about yourself? I mean, people who don't have self-love really are not able to love other people well. I mean, you're seeing this played out, I think, in politics with certain kinds of toxic personalities. But if you have those three things, character, competence, and caring, it will sustain a relationship. Now, the problem is, if you don't have one of them, it falls apart. So if you don't have caring, it falls apart. If you're not competent, it falls apart. It actually collapses. But when it comes to happiness, Harvard did it's called the Harvard Mann Study. It's called different things, the WT Grant Study. But it's a 75-year study that was done on people who went to the Harvard Business School. And they did a comparison study with kids from Boston who were from poor families. And they tracked them for 75 years, and they took their blood. They did self-report things every 2 years with them. Some of these, they started with about 650 people. And there's only about 50 still alive. Okay, they're all in their 90s. What they found was the men, and they were all men because back then that's all it was. The men who had deep, serious relationships with people, loving relationships, live the longest and were the happiest. And if you ever want to see the results of that study, go to put TED Talk in Harvard study. It's a wonderful 12-minute video by the guy who is now the head of the study. There have been five of these guys, because many of them have actually died over time. But it's probably one of the best videos it's very heartwarming and it's very honest. But that's the finding. The guy who wrote the book is correct. I use the same. I said the same thing in my book called Positive Leadership, saying that relationships. I mean, that's not the only thing, but it's a core factor and happiness. There are other things that we found that make people happy. Working at jobs in the areas of strengths is a big, big factor in happiness. Are you working in the areas that you're good at? And we also found out things like gratitude, for example, just being grateful and just writing. Like we have one of the things I have my clients do is write down at the end of every day three things they're grateful for, or three things that went well in their life, that kind of thing. If you do that over a period of time, it makes you far more empathetic and it makes you far more willing to help people. I've been doing this for 7 years now, 7 years, I guess. Every night I have I went to CVS, got a little notebook. I have it I put it in my medicine cabinet. I have a little pen and it's right underneath my Lipitor. I have to take that at night. So I take that down and I write every night. I've been doing this for 7 years. I have got stacks of these things. And in the morning, I have another one by my bedside and I write down three things that I'm optimistic about. And I wrote this down that I was optimistic about this, having fun with this today. And it's amazing how you sort of self-prophesize. And the effect that gratitude has in it. There's lots of studies been done on gratitude and what an effect that has on your well-being and your general happiness. So, yeah, I'm right with your friend that, being connected to people. This is why COVID is so difficult for people. And why I think it's why I don't think people are stupid. I really don't. I think they're driven to connect as a tribe. And that's what's forcing people to actually take unbelievable risks. We're going to see in 3 weeks from now, after this, you're going to see a horrible spike. You just will. I mean, you don't have to be an epidemiologist to figure that out. 3 million people traveling, you figure, you know, the percentage of them is going to be really high. But they're doing it because they want to be with people they love. That's what's driving it. You know, it's what makes people do all kinds of stuff. In a way, it's heartwarming, but in another way, it's very scary because you just know, you talk to listen to a guy like Fauci. This guy's been doing this for, 80 years. I mean, he knows kind of what he's talking about. So, but I do think what's driving it is this desire to be together as a clan, as a tribe, you know, with people we care about. Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting too how we dive into this and you talk about the connectedness. So you mentioned that culture in your book is really a feeling of being safe, connected, and purposeful.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because I think some companies, when you listen to a leader and they talk about culture, it's like, oh no, it's just culture. Like culture eats strategy all day. Yeah. I think culture can be a strategy, but I don't think it is the strategy. I think that the companies who said our culture is, you know, we go to happy hour every Thursday after work, you know, they're the first ones who said, yeah, let's just do happy hour on Zoom. Right. And that didn't, fizzled out because it didn't have that connectedness. So talk to me a little bit about that aspect, especially being purposeful, because I know you are also living a very purposeful life these days as well. You mentioned this earlier.
Yeah. Sort of what we found, and this is just a riff on Maslow, but beyond that, I'll think of it in a second, has done a lot of work on safety, on psychological safety. Psychological safety is at the very basis for not only physical safety, first of all. I mean, if it's that bad, we're hoping that you're working in a place that's not physically unsafe, but psychologically, can you tell the truth to power? And we've seen instances now with the current administration and others, it's not just this administration, others as well, where it's very difficult to tell the truth to power because they don't want to hear it. You know, a lot of businesses don't want to hear it. You know, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear solutions and all that kind of stuff. Well, sometimes you have to hear the bad stuff. But if you cut me down, I'm not going to raise my hand again. And nor is anybody else in the room. And we've all witnessed that happening. Beyond that, once people feel safe psychologically, they want to feel connected to something. They want to be part of a team. Everybody wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. And then that final piece is this idea of purpose. And yeah, actually, there's some interesting research now between purpose and meaning, without getting into splitting hairs. What you have to find out is meaningful acts in the day. The small things like when somebody brings you in goes out for a cup of coffee and then brings you a cup because they know what you drink. You say, I thought, you know, you enjoy this. That brings great meaning. It provides great meaning to the person giving it to you, and it provides meaning to you. Like, hey, really got a friend here. You know, it's kind of nice. So the small things, and then larger things, the larger, more purposeful things sometimes are scare people. So that's why I tell people, look for day-to-day meaningful things. But also, you know, if you can hitch yourself to something you really believe in, whether it's education or whether it's philanthropy or whether it's just doing or being the best at what you do, that could be a great goal for you. But sometimes people get overwhelmed by, well, I'm not doing this huge thing. I'm wiping a baby's rear end, you know, if I'm staying home with a kid. But there can be meaning in that if you think, hey, I'm taking care of this kid, and this young rascal may grow up to be the president, or may grow up to be a senator. Sometimes you have to take joy in the small things that you do in life. So one thing I did that was fun. So every morning I write at Pete's up at King's Park. So I'm pointing where it is. Anyway, I sit in the back and I go there every morning from 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock, and I write. That's what I do. I've been doing this for 20 years. And one day I decided to, I had a lot of money left over from vacation. So I decided to I told the guy at the counter, Mike, kind of a grumpy guy, but a nice guy, kind of a little grumpy. But I said to Mike, hey, here's $50, buy coffee for people coming through. And he did that, and people came through, and they really, you know, they'd be out there at the barista place, waiting for their coffee. They're all talking about, hey, isn't this cool? We just got this. I told them, don't tell them who, you know, don't tell them I did. I want to be anonymous. But I started to watch the way it started to change Mike. He got more into as he started giving away the coffee, he got more into giving it away. And I gave him another $50 after this because it was such a great experiment. I noticed him changing. By the end of it, he was saying things like, you know, our donor would like you to, he was donor, I never said that, you know, our donor would like to wish you a happy day, and he'd like you to pay it forward. And I never said pay it forward, you know, but he got into this thing, and literally my little bit of philanthropy changed his meaning in life. And he became a different person as he did that. I mean, it was incredible. That's why I went the extra $50, because I wanted to see, I could see him sort of changing. And I thought, whoa, what's going on here? You know, the experiment was see how other people are affected by getting the gift. But the real experiment was how it affected him. And then Harvard did a follow-up study on that. And they actually did a study at the business school where they split this group in half, and they gave half of the people $10. And they said, go out and spend it on yourself. And the other half, go out and spend it on somebody else. And when they collated the data, the happiest people were the people that gave it away to somebody else, by far. So, you know, I don't know where the hell that came from, but anyway, the idea here is, you know, getting purpose, getting meaning in your life comes from, you know, it doesn't have to be huge. It can be small things that over time kind of push you in a direction, I'd say, you know.
And this focus on meaning in life, like it's something that's followed you throughout your entire life. I'm thinking back from your mom all the way throughout your career and how you coach people now. I know that you are involved with our friends, NVFS, Northern Virginia Family Services.
Yeah, I'm the chairman.
I'd love to hear more about your involvement with them and your vision and why you take so much pride in being a part of that organization.
You know, I've been on a board forever. I'll always get on some kind of community thing. And I had been on the Community Foundation Board, which is another large organization. And at 9 years, you max out, you have to get off. And they kept me for 9 years, and I had a wonderful time. And I had about 6 months, I'm off this board. I'm getting postpartum depression here. I'm getting post-board depression. And so I called Mary A. Gipp, and I said, listen, I don't know that if you ever need board members, but I would love to serve. Or even not in the board, just any way I can serve. I would, you know, put me in charge of, you know, I don't know, whatever, education or something. I'll do whatever. And so they had an opening, and they brought me on board. And it's just, it's a phenomenal organization. You know, 35,000 people we touch a year, a budget of $30 or $40 million. It's a huge organization, but the people that run it, Stephanie Berkowitz and her staff, are amazing. I mean, and doing it all through COVID has just shown how amazing they are. You know, we take care of people that fall through the cracks. You know, this is, you have an abused mother comes to you with two kids in the middle of the night saying, I can't go back home because this guy's going to kill us. I mean, and we take them in, we get them in a shelter, we get them food, we get the kids in school, we get them counselors, we get trauma people talking to them. I mean, it's a real wraparound kind of, that's the goal. The goal is to have a really solid wraparound set of services. But, you know, it's an amazing organization. And the people that have come on our board are just, I mean, they're the best folks I've ever worked with. And I get much more from, I learn a lot from watching our staff work with families. And I've gotten out, and I was very active in getting out and sort of being where they were at the site of, you know, I was at a Christmas party with a bunch of adopted kids, you know, and I've been with families that are going through trauma. They've let me sit in on some of the interviews. It's just, it's amazing stuff. But you don't think of it in Northern Virginia. You think, well, Northern Virginia's got plenty of money. No, it doesn't. 25% of the population in Northern Virginia is below the poverty line. That's a lot of people. And that's, you know, Route 1 corridor, it's very geographical, I can tell you that. I mean, it's mostly Route 1 in that area, Colmore. You know, you don't have a lot of poverty in McLean or in Great Falls, you know. But they're in, if you take the county as a whole, 25% is below the poverty level. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And it's been a lot of fun. And we have... been active. My wife and I have given, you know, money, time, talent, anything we can. I teach the staff free. I do whatever they need. If they call me up and say, hey, can you help us do this? The answer is always, yeah. Yeah, there's no, we won't. We'll just do it, whatever it is, if it helps. And navigating, can you imagine navigating? We have 500 kids in Head Start. So we're the size of a pretty good sized school. We have 500 kids in Head Start. And then with COVID, we had to take them off of Head Start. We're trying to bring them back with certain protocols. We have to go through all the stuff that the Fairfax County is going through to do all that as well. And it's amazing to see that staff do it. I mean, these folks don't work. They don't make a lot of money. In fact, what did she say? I forgot what it was. I'll probably get this wrong, so I don't want to say it, but it's like 30% of 20-30%, it's a big number of our staff qualifies for our services. You know, it's like we're not paying them what we should pay them. So that's one of my goals, is to pay staff, get all the staff above, so none of our staff qualifies for our services. Not because I don't want to give them the services, but I don't want them being paid that low. And, you know, it's hard to do right now, but that's the goal. The goal is to raise enough money to get everybody over there. It's a great organization. You're right.
Well, I know you've done a ton. I mean, you've told us this, and hopefully it's okay for others to hear this, but I mean, you're at that point now in your life where I feel like you're working mostly to support others.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think that's just so commendable. You know, there's so many people out there.
Let me tell you the dirty secret though. Here's the dirty secret with philanthropy that people don't know. What the research says and what we have experienced is the person giving the services, the money. Actually, they've done this with neurotransmitters. The person giving it is actually much better off than the person getting it. If you looked at both of our brains, when I was giving you something or you were giving me something, that the person getting it, part of their brain, the rewards part of their brain lights up like a nickel. But the brain, the size of the part of my brain is about the size of a silver dollar. It's much larger. And that's what people just don't understand. The minute you get into this idea of giving back, it's self-fulfilling. I mean, it's amazing. I never thought of it, to be honest with you, but it's incredible the way you feel personally when you do this. So there's, yeah, commendable, but it's also, it kind of feels pretty good.
And also the key to a happy, long life, you know, going back to what you mentioned before. So
yeah. Look at Warren Buffett. That Buffett could, you know, he's gonna give away billions of dollars. And even Jeff Bezos, you know, I actually hired Jeff Bezos when he was a kid, when he was first starting Amazon, and everybody thought he was an idiot. I mean, everybody thought he was an idiot. I brought him back to DC to speak at a conference that I was running. You know, I don't know how old he was at the time, but this is like 20, some 20, 25 years ago. He was just starting out. Everybody, he was driving a 1987 Honda Accord. He was, he had no money, and he had just moved his family to the West Coast. And everybody thought he was an idiot. We were bringing him back for this conference to talk about this thing called Amazon. The people said, no, selling books online will never work. I mean, this is ridiculous. Harcourt Brace was there, you know, all these big publishers were there and thinking, oh my God, this guy's an idiot. And boy, he wasn't an idiot. I mean, he turned out to be the smartest guy in there. But the amount of money he's given away now is phenomenal. And the fact that he bought the Washington Post and kept it alive. Can you imagine not having the Post and New York Times doing what they're doing now to keep track of what's going on? I mean, he sunk a ton of money into talk about a public service. But, you know, buying the Washington Post is a huge investment for him, and also a very personal one because, you know, politicians that don't like him are trying to take out on his business. I mean, he lost a contract with the federal government because of it, a huge one with the Pentagon. So that kind of self-sacrifice is really around us, and we've got some great examples, I think, in the U.S., and I think more and more people are figuring out, you know, that giving is the way to go. And people who are acquisitive, who try to acquire things, they're fearful. There's two big emotions that have been studied, fear and hope. They're the opposite. Fear keeps you where you are and in the past, and it makes you very protective. Hope takes you into the future, makes you open, makes you vulnerable, makes you more human. You know, if you have to have one, hope is what's going to drive you. All fear gets you is an immediate vote somewhere. Or if you want somebody to do something, you just make them fearful because they'll freeze. It's a primal kind of thing. But if you want to move a society forward, you got to give them hope, which is why I think Obama did really well, you know, hope in the future, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm not trying to be political. I'm just saying, really, there's a difference between the two. In a business, you got somebody who comes in and said, if you don't do it, we're going to fire you. That's a very different kind of business than a business that says, let's go out there, let's make some mistakes, let's learn from them, let's grow together. What do you say? Not a hard choice.
Well, you certainly make it easy to give people hope, especially, you know, taking a look at the way you've lived your life and supporting others. And, you know, I think teaching the lessons of leadership, right? So I just think about, again, kind of the ricochet effect of that, of how many people that they then went on to influence in a positive way too. So, you know, hats off to you, Steve. If people are looking to get in touch with you, how would you recommend they do that?
Just call me up.
Cool.
Right, just call my cell phone, 703-424-3780, or email me at sgladys@stevegladys.com. Yeah, I'm just sitting here like everybody else. I'm, you know, I'm working in my basement like everybody else, you know, the best part of this whole thing is you can get hold of anybody you want now. I mean, you can call anybody and get them because they're all home and they're all dying to get on the phone or get away from, you know, whatever going on in the next room. So yeah, I'm very available and happy to talk to people. And I like to talk to people because even if I'm not getting anything out of it from a business perspective, I just find that if you help people, their tendency is to want to help other people. The idea of reciprocity is really a very basic sort of thing. So, you know, it all comes out in the wash. You're doing a good job now. You're helping people by talking, by getting this podcast out there. And in fact, I listened to Victor Hoskins the other day because I had never listened to much of the podcast. So I listened to a couple of them and I listened to Victor and I'm actually on a board with him now. So it gave me some great insights as to who he is. Wow. He's not the kind of guy I want to follow. He's a pretty dynamic guy. That's for sure.
Yeah. But a lot of energy. Well, you know, we'll probably have some more of your friends on here soon too. So we've been doing our research and you're connected to a few other people that are coming up on season two. So you'll be in good company.
Great. Well, they're all, you know, we're lucky to be in this area. I mean, this is, I never thought I'd live in an area like this. I mean, it's just amazing. You can throw a rock and hit somebody who's kind of a rock star. It's just, they're all over the place. And you guys are the good part is you guys are the future. We get a chance to see the future. That's why I like teaching, because you're looking at the eyes of the future. You know, I've taught at Mason for 25 years, and many of my students now are CEOs of companies and things like that now that, you know, have far exceeded anything I ever did. But it's such a great idea to be teaching a group of 18 or 20 year olds and know that you know, many of them are now out there and, you know, hiring people and doing all kinds of great work. That's just it's very fulfilling. It really is.
Awesome. Well, we really, again, appreciate you coming on the show, and if we can ever help, just let us know.
Yeah, thank you. And same here. I appreciate it. And Jess, thanks so much for your wise comments and for reading the book. You guys actually read it. You know, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. No, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, same here.
Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this episode and subscribe to future episodes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to give us that 5-star review so that we can get our podcast out to more and more listeners. If you are a business leader or know of any business leaders that you would like to nominate to be a guest on the show, please visit us at thenovabusinesspodcast.com.